I started a minute early tonight instead of a few minutes late that I've been starting lately. This is the Technical Net. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and you'll also hear two or three other guys on this particular repeater running this Technical Net. John KC2WGB is a surgeon. He maintains the mailbag and monitors the echo ring. So if you have trouble signing in because of the stand by a minute.
Next tonight at 8.
I had my antenna aimed in the wrong direction, which I'm slowly discovering. Yeah, that's a lot better. John, KC2WG, maintains the mailbag and also monitors Echo Link, so if you had trouble signing in because we didn't give a big enough gap, John will know about it and let us know. Then after that, you'll hear Paul, WS2N. This is the space report. NASA's always doing some interesting things, as well as the other European and Asian space agencies along the way. HAL, K60PZ, has a lot of experience and a lot of electronics and gives us a briefer answers on occasion. We have this loose menu that we follow. First hour is people who check in with questions and comments, followed by a mailbag where John will choose a number of the communications that he has received from people who don't yet have their ham license or don't yet have the right equipment to talk to us directly. Let me drop.
Real quick, Dick, RYY would like to check in with a question, just to let you know.
Hey, we got Joe, W2RYY. He's on the list. I bet you're, Eric, are you going to be checking in with a question tonight? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Actually, if you're interested, I'll give you my response to the last question, which I did a lot of investigating and studying about, and learned an awful lot of stuff about instrument oscillators, how I'm going to approach dealing with my issue, because it's like a $6,000 part.
Yeah, we were using Yig-tuned oscillators and tracking Yig-tuned filters. That I had designed the constant current operational amplifier circuits that swept those two and kept them tracked as they swept them. So it was a tracking constant current pair of generators. And I think our Yig filters we were paying something like $600 for, and I think a little bit shy of $1,000 with the Yig-tuned oscillator. Back in the days when the AIO had something called the AIO 707 Spectrum Analyzer, which was the first spectrum analyzer on the market with 100 decibels of dynamic range on the screen. Up until then, the maximum anyone had was 70 dB. So are you saying that your particular Yig-tuned oscillator with its offset circuitry so that it has both phase lock loop and IF and whatever all in one package, did I hear you say that that one component is $6,000 of you, Eric?
Yeah, shipped from Japan with courtesy and air transportation. Actually, it is just the Yig-tuned oscillator, but it also has the first mixture built into the same package. Everything else is external.
Yeah, there's ways of making some of the Yig spheres underneath that magnetic pole are a filter, some of them are an oscillator, some of them are a filter tuned off to one side, which gives you an IF or an IF either for spectrum analyzer work or for the phase lock loop function. So some of these very elaborate detuned oscillator slash filter things can perform a lot of magic, but the alignment on those is a real edge-of-the-art type thing to properly align one of those. Each of the Yig spheres have to be very specifically oriented as far as their internal, let's call it grain, is concerned, versus the kind of jazz. The right key was resonance. So there's a lot of black magic that goes into one of those, Eric. Alrighty. When we do take check-ins, which I'm about to do in a few seconds, let me drop. People who do have a question or a comment, I'm going to give John, me, Paul, and Hal. You're going to give us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. He's not trying to just because you're listening. This is TechNet number 1584 of the series that began September of 1982. By now, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't necessarily prove to us anymore. I'd like to be hearing from people who've got some, because they attended Ham Radio University today. How was that? And by the way, Eric, you might know, because I looked at the Limock log, and it didn't say, the Ham Radio University that took place today, what was the number? Was that the eighth in a series? Over you, Eric, if you happen to know, KETVJ, KQLIW.
All I know is I've gone to a lot of them. I don't know whether it's eight or whatever. I'm really the wrong person to ask, so sorry.
Yeah, I'll be asking people that question. What number HIU was this? And Newsday said there were 400 people there. And what was it like for you? I wasn't there, unfortunately. But the... if we have a lot of time left over tonight, we might get into Fourier series, Fourier transform. We might get into F2 propagation refraction. Everybody says that the signal bounces off the ionosphere. Well, it acts like a bounce if you look at it by zooming real back, real far back. But it really is a refractive function by which the signal enters the ionosphere, gets curved into another direction, and comes back as if it has bounced, but it's not really a bounce. What's the difference between reflection and refraction is an interesting question. So we might get into some of those things if everybody is sleeping because they had to get up so early for HIU and we don't have very much sign in tonight. Let's see who we've got to sign in who does have a question or a comment. So far we've got Joe RYY and Eric KE2EJ. Anyone else with questions or comments? Give me a call letters and name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WA2YYL, Dave.
KC2WGB with a question. WS2I with the space report. Channel 12 said 17th year.
17th year of Ham Radio University. That sounds like a high number, but could very well be. RYL. Do I have you correctly, Dave? Romeo Yankee Lima. Over to you, Dave.
Close. WA2YYL, Yankee Yankee Lima. And, yeah, I have a question about,
okay, you're on the list. And one last call. So we've got, Joe, Eric, Dave, John, and, anyone else? Give me a call letters and name right now if you've got a question or a comment for the TechNet. Okay, we've got more than enough to get going. Joe, WK2RYY, you're number one on the runway tonight, K2RYW.
Good evening, all. Good evening, Dick. WK2RYY here. My question is this. How is the efficiency of an oil burner measured, and can it be done with inexpensive equipment? Back to you.
Yeah, I'm going to be throwing that out to the group, because every so often we have a good number of people who listen, who have got oil burner expertise. Although I've been maintaining mine for 45 years, I don't consider myself an expert. I've done certain things and I've gotten away with it. I do know that a gallon of oil, completely oxidized and burned, produces something in the vicinity of 120,000 BTUs per gallon, something in that neighborhood. And that, depending on exactly which version of the oil they're serving to you, it's going to be slightly above or slightly below that number in now, how would I measure efficiency? I can certainly measure the number of gallons per hour that are going into the machine by various techniques. Of all the things that you and I can buy at Sid Harvey, don't think I've ever seen a gauge that measures gallons per hour of flow through the pipe. And that's a little bit of a problem. But now, how would you measure the number of BTU you're getting out of that flame when some of it's being radiated into that firebox, some of it's being radiated through the water supply if you've got a hot water system, some of it's radiated through the air if it's a warm water system like I've got? That's a toughie. Huh. And by the way, I should have mentioned last week when the job was ready. So whenever you look at antennas that are close proximity to each other, dipole-like things, for instance, that are either broadside to each other or in-fire from each other, there's something called the mutual impedance phenomenon. If I had a pair of dipoles, both resonated on the same frequency, as I change the spacing between them, the antenna that I'm looking into is going to, in some cases, see extra inductance at some spacing. At some spacings, it's going to see extra capacitance. Some spacings, it's going to see higher or lower impedances. The so-called mutual impedance curves, which are not easy to interpret, but they are in the reference data for radio engineers, that some of what you were asking last week or the week before, but complicating that is the fact that your nearby antennas were not on the same frequency. So nearby antennas on some of the frequencies can give you some pretty crazy impedance phenomena and changes the impedance of the antenna that you're looking into because of the presence of the other antennas. That's when you got real close spacing, like you would have on a mobile vehicle, for instance. So that's not an easy one to figure out what's going on. Let's see if anybody out there with oil burner experience can give us a hint as to how you measure the efficiency of your particular oil burner. K2RIW listening.
WGB with a quick comment.
Go ahead, John, and see how you would do it.
It's quite difficult to do because you have to have the original manufacturer's specs. Then you have the aging of the boiler, the coating that provides insulation like cigar ashes do. Well, oil ash does the same thing. So you have to know, they do make a beaker that is metered, and you fill it up with maybe a gallon, it's usually a half a gallon, you run the burner and you make your measurements. But the elevation of the temperature of the water in the unit, depending on how much is in there, of course, and the time it takes to elevate it, all of the calorimetry can be done, but it is not easy to get an accurate display. So there's a lot involved there, and it's always compared to the manufacturer's specs, which, you know, should be pretty accurate. They do an awful lot of that type of testing. It can be done, but I don't know of any easy way to do it.
Go right ahead, Eric.
If I was going to consider efficiency of the fuel that I'm using, I kind of like ignore what John basically said. And the simplest thing you can do if you want to do telemetric places. The whole point of having a heating system is a piece of air in the room at a particular temperature, right? And whatever it takes to raise the room temperature by 1 degree versus the period of time times the amount of fuel, you can now calculate how efficient the entire system is. And if you want to calculate the efficiency of the boiler, then you're going to actually have to capture all of the lost heat and subtract that from the total to get what the efficiency of the boiler is in terms of how much heat is transferred into the device to target and how much heat is thrown away. There you go. So RWK3J.
Yeah, measuring the heating of the house has a huge number of variables, Eric. That's a tough way to go. Your house and my house may have a different number of thickness of panes of glass in our thermal pane windows. You may have a lot bigger picture window than me. I may have better insulation in the walls and the ceiling. The wind may be blowing. That's a tough one. A lot of variables involved. I think the closest I've heard so far is what John just said. If my furnace has just been cleaned, and therefore I have no soot or scale on the heat exchanger. In other words, the surface the flame touches to heat the water. And now I don't turn on the circulator. I watch the fuel being drained out of a fluid, out of a flask of some kind, where I can easily measure how much fuel got consumed, and I can measure the change in the temperature of the water in the boiler. That's a beautiful calorimetry test, as I see it. And I think the correlation between that and efficiency could be pretty darn good. On top of that, the next step would be to measure the temperature of the flue gases. I mean, that which the flame is making heat, and that heat that doesn't get coupled to the boiler into the water, then it goes up the chimney. And you could measure the temperature and the number of cubic feet per minute of air going up the temperature of up the chimney. That's probably one of your major loss mechanisms. Assuming that the fuel was thoroughly combusted, you're not making soot. Let me drop it. By way of one of those soot measuring syringes like thing where you put a piece of filter paper in there and draw out some of the flue gas and look at the color of the flue deposit on your piece of filter paper. You'd like it to be a tan color, which usually represents complete combustion. And the more it looks black, soot, it really means incomplete combustion. So, that's a toughie.
The comment?
Yeah, go ahead, John.
That's funny, because I couldn't care less about the individual things. All I care about is how much am I going to pay for heat up the damn house.
Oh, yeah. What you've got is a very practical question. How many gallons am I consuming in order to bring my house on the standard day from 65 degrees to 70 degrees? That's a very practical answer. And therefore, you've got the dollars per degree Fahrenheit, so to speak. But whether or not your burner is running at 40% efficiency or 89% efficiency is really the question that Joe is asking. Because if it was 49%, you know that there's something you can do about it. If it's 89%, you sit back and say, yeah, that's good enough. KC2WGB, K2RIW, let's see how you would do this, John.
KC2WGB. Well, Eric is 100% right, because what you're paying for is the overall efficiency of the vessel it's heating, plus the burner. But you would start out with the efficiency of the burner, see if it meets manufacturer specs, then work from there. That's the way it was. I was at many of these analysis testing devices and different systems that were being tested, and flue gas analysis, it's really involved. But basically what Eric is saying, and like you said, if you have drafty windows, and you're going to find out what the overall efficiency is, you need both analysis, I believe. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
I got one more thing to say.
And if I know you, Eric, you probably have R40 or R80 insulation in your house. Is that true?
No, I know you know the story, but, you know, when I first got the house and we did the thermal measurements of the house didn't keep it. The house didn't keep anything in. It just let everything out. We built the house. It did all the insulation and anything else. I mean, the heating door in the house is something that's in oil is something up to like $500 a month. It's ridiculous. Changed all the windows, redid all the insulation. Yeah, the R number is about 35 in terms of looking at it from the whole thing. Now, the fact that the house can keep the heater, I don't have to worry about how much do I have to continually pump into it. Now it becomes worthwhile looking at the efficiency of the boiler. How efficient is it? I'm making a change from a 10% improvement, I'm making a 20% improvement, and that adds up to a lot. But I still look at the whole thing as a system. If you want to start off making it efficient, start with what you're eating. Don't worry about what's heating it in the beginning. You know, make your improvements of the external part of it. Then make the improvements of the actual engine that provides the heat.
Where the house that you bought was leaking heat so bad, it sounds like you bought a fixer-upper. And I'm guessing it took a good, solid, hard-working year to get it from the fixer-upper stage to where you are right now. Is that true, Eric?
Well, I'll make a long story short, Dick. This is the house that I grew up in. It had the original a cement wall for insulation in it. It's over 50 years old.
Well,
I basically took everything down to the studs. I mean, it could have been, you know, if you didn't mind going back to the 60s, it was perfectly livable the way it was, but it's really, I had its issues. You know, 50-year-old roof, but it's time to go. I put new windows in it. It cleaned up all the leaks. I made it really efficient, so when it gets to be like 20 degrees outside and the heat's not on, it still stays about 60 inside.
In your early youth, when you were living in that house, if it was an oil burner, in those days, what do you remember as the price of oil? Was it something like 25 cents a gallon?
Yeah, when I started driving gasoline, we're 27 cents a gallon. Yeah, it was something in the order of 15 or 20 cents a gallon at that point with my parents bought the house.
And if you had a crystal ball at that time, and you told people that the day will happen where for a brief period of time we're paying $4.30 or whatever it was per gallon instead of 25 cents a gallon for oil, whoa. That is a percentage of increase that's just out of sight. I guess the manufacturer of an oil burner has to go through some pretty elaborate instrumentation tests to measure efficiency. In theory, if he's telling the truth, he's got the best numbers we're ever going to get, assuming it's nice and clean and properly adjusted. And I always adjust my oil burner for a little bit less than the highest possible efficiency. I'd like having a flame that's a little bit rich on air and a little bit lean on fuel. And the reason I do that is because I wanted a tan kind of soot instead of a black soot, because the black soot is an insulator, which downrange is going to hurt your efficiency in a fairly insidious manner. On top of that, if there's any leak in the system, and if you're getting incomplete combustion, then you're making a certain amount of carbon monoxide. So I always like to make the flame a little bit lean on fuel, so that if I had equipment that could absolutely peak the efficiency. I know that the nozzle on a good day, particularly if I get it up to 150 pounds per square inch, pump pressure into the oil squirting nozzle, I know it's going to make some very fine molecules, what's the word for it, globules of oil, the aerosol, so to speak, the individual microscopic spheres. But if they do range as a Gaussian distribution, some of them are larger, some of them are smaller. And if you set the air mixture just right, you're burning the ones in the middle of the Gaussian curve. And the larger ones are the ones that are not going to be completely combusted. So you're going to be making a certain amount of soot if you don't make the mixture a little bit lean on fuel, a little bit rich on air, as I say. So we haven't got a great answer for you on this one, Joe, but at least we discussed some of the details. Hopefully, drag your feet a little bit in case we have somebody who knows how to measure efficiency of an oil burner that's listening to us. To be to RYY with a little bit of delay, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Well, I don't have much to add, except I've heard those same figures that you mentioned, that around 87-89% is probably considered pretty good for an oil burner, but I just was kind of wondering, you know, the procedure of how you go at actually measuring that. There is apparently instrumentation, expensive instrumentation, that apparently does measure that and give the serviceman a direct reading right at the time he tests it what that percentage number is. Back to you.
From what you've read on that one, Joe, is that a system that takes a sample of the flue gases and does a rather thorough analysis? Is that one of the methods by which the efficiency is measured? So it measures what chemical constituents exist in that flue gas, what temperature is that, how many cubic feet per minute of air are flowing through, and by some means figure out how many gallons per hour are flowing into the oil burner. You get a medium good analysis as to how many gallons per hour as a function of your nozzle. The nozzle is rated for 100 pounds per square inch of oil pressure, and if you happen to be running 100 pounds per square inch, and you're running a nozzle that's rated at 0.85 gallons per hour, in theory it's going to be pretty close to that amount of oil consumption of that particular nozzle. So, to repeat my question, from what you've read, is a big fraction of that analysis, a big fraction of that analysis, done by sampling the flue gases and their temperature? Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
It seems to be so, and I think you've watched the same videos I've watched on YouTube. I think I sent you the string of videos by Gray Furnace Man. He goes through a whole bunch of stuff on how to service the oil burner, how to do different checks at different points, and one particular instrument he does use apparently does measure the efficiency of the oil burner, because he does tell you that. He also tells you how much oxygen it's using, and other various things. And he is making measurements in the stack, and also making measurements, air measurements on the inside of the viewing port, where you can open up to actually look at the flame. But that's what, you know, using an instrumentation he had. I didn't know if you had to go out and buy something like that to be able to do that, or if there was a simpler way of calculating these kind of measurements.
B2CMF with a comment?
I think it was WB2CMF. Starts with your name, sir. And let's see what oil burner experience you have. Over to you, sir.
Thank you. Take the name here is Pat, Papa Alpha Tango. The generally accepted industry method of measuring the efficiency is usually by looking at the stack, you know, the stack of flue gases. And you can go out to and get a back rack tester, and generally the method of testing the efficiency is by taking a CO2 reading and a stack temperature. And the two of them put together, they give you a very nice little chart. You can look up a stack temperature of 500-600 degrees and a CO2 reading of 11%, 12%, 13%. You put that all together and it comes up with an efficiency of about 80% to 85%. You're not going to get much more than 85% because it's also generally accepted that fuel oil has about 15% of impurities in it.
How about that? 15% impurities. Wow. Are those impurities, are they, you know, pieces of silicon that get deposited somewhere? Out of curiosity, Pat, what do you believe is the nature of those impurities? Over to you.
Well, I never really got a straight answer. You know, many years ago, I had taken a course in oil burners and all that. And, you know, I was told, you know, a gallon of oil has 140,000 BTUs, but because of all the impurities in fuel oil, you're only going to get 15% less than that. And the impurities include water, sulfur, the garbage they put in there to color it, and a whole bunch of other stuff that they never really went into too much detail, but they generally accepted that it's about 15%. And I know measuring when I used to do that when I was much younger, I never saw efficiencies higher than 86%. And I know my own boiler, which is fairly efficient, is only about 83%, 84%.
Out of curiosity, Pat, do you happen to know some brand names that when used correctly, when they're properly set, are able to give you these high efficiency numbers? Do you have a favorite brand name, like maybe Bryant? It's just a pure guess on my part. Over to you, Pat.
Do you have any favorites? At the time, Peerless was, was sought after, but they had their problems too. Of course, everyone knows Juan McLean, and, you know, all the boilers have their own unique problems. The only other comment I'll make is, you know, there's a big difference between burner efficiency and system efficiency. And Eric was really talking about the overall system efficiency, and there's really two different things. I guess the question was, can you measure it? And the answer is yes, you can measure it. The instrumentation, I don't think it's that expensive. Although, I have a CO2 tester that's liquid, and I have a standard thermometer that you put into the stack. between those two instruments and a smoke tester, you know, those are the only three instruments that most people use, and you can measure your efficiency fairly well.
In the case of the heat going up the chimney, because the flue gases are kind of hot, I might be coming out a little bit ahead on that one. I had to replace my burner. Somebody had convinced me, a ham radio operator, who is now a silent key living in Hempstead. Uncle Willie, we used to call him, W2UWC, I think was his call letters. Uncle Willie Charlie, he called himself. So he was an oil burner service person with a lot of years of service. And he talked me into buying a Bryant. And I really needed the flue to come out of the furnace on, let's say, the west side. When it's mated with my plenum for the warm air system. Well, that particular furnace, the flue didn't exit the west side, it exited the east side, the exact wrong side. So I have a great big U-joint, a U-turn of all of my flue pipes, and they're screwed together so that they don't disconnect. But I've got this great big long flue pipe before it enters into the chimney. As such, that's one hell of a heat exchanger. Those the flue gases, in my case, going up the chimney have been tremendously cool because, I don't know the exact number, but if I'm making a guess, I've got something like 10 extra feet of flue pipe in my basement giving up the heat. So I've got an additional heat exchanger. When you're talking about furnace efficiency versus efficiency of the overall system, where could inefficiency be? If I'm losing heat, if the flame is giving me the heat, and I'm losing it somewhere in the furnace, but the furnace is inside my house, other than having stack temperature that's too high, I don't know of any other mechanism.
Repeater, time out.
I don't know of any other mechanism by which you could be losing efficiency of the system where it's not dumping the wasted heat into the house. Am I naive on that one, Pat? WB2CMF, K2LIW.
K2LIW, WB2CMF. That could be a whole other topic, just, you know, talking about efficiency, but I'll give you a simple case that they always used to tell me about. You know, the ideal case would be if your burner was running 100% of the time. You know, but of course it doesn't. So you can take the case where we'll take a hot water boiler. You've heated the water up in the boiler so that it circulates throughout the house, heating the house. You've got a certain amount of flue gas going up the chimney, so that's definitely a loss. But when that burner shuts down, you continue to put heat up the chimney, thereby cooling down the furnace. Or the boiler in this case, and that's going nowhere but up the chimney, so that can be considered a loss. How they combat that is sort of all the new boilers, I know the gas boilers, and even some of the newer oil burners, they actually have a damper on the stack, such that when the burner shuts off, the chimney is closed so that the heat doesn't escape up the chimney. That's just one of the simple things that you can think about. I'm sure there's 100 others. Like I said, that could be a whole topic in itself.
I think I'm moving in that direction in the correct way, because I've always taken my furnace and anyone else's furnace that I can talk somebody into following my philosophy. If your furnace is delivered with a nozzle of 0.85 gallons per hour, I talk them into using a 0.65, a 0.6, a 0.55. If you use a smaller gallons per hour nozzle, the furnace now runs closer to 100% of the time on a cold day. Therefore, the overall efficiency, you're not doing a whole lot of starting up and closing down, so to speak. You come out way ahead on that one. The slight disadvantage of that is that if there's a super cold day, if there's a 0 degree Fahrenheit day with a high wind, my furnace running 100% of the time with an undersized nozzle may only bring the house up to 65 degrees Fahrenheit. And my family is rugged enough, and we got ski clothing. That event that occurs once per 3 years we're willing to put on our ski jacket and tend to keep our house, keep ourselves warm inside our house. Another huge advantage of an undersized nozzle with proper airflow, let me drop it, is not only is it running closer to 100% of the time on a cold day, and it is at a hell of a lot quieter. A number of my friends, they really need, in my opinion, 0.6 gallons per hour out of the nozzle most of the time to keep the house happy, and is running 1 and 1.1 gallons per hour nozzle. And the flame in the furnace is noisy as all hell. Very loud rumble. And how people tolerate that. I mean, they've lived with that all their life. They think that's the sound of a furnace. And it has to be that loud a rumble where it shakes the whole house. I bet you've seen conditions like that one, Pat. And in one particular case, one of my friends, I talked them into putting in a smaller nozzle. This whole system ran a hell of a lot quieter, and in my opinion, more efficiency, and they were happy. The other friend of mine, when I tried talking them into talking to their service person into doing that, the service person ended up shouting at them that I know my business, this is the way it's supposed to be, leave me alone. And that person got so disgusted, she eventually ended up removing the oil burner and putting in a gas burner. Over to you, Pat, on size of nozzle versus rumbling sounds. Did the B2CMF, K2LIW in the deck then?
K2LIW, WB2CMF. Well, the cause of rumbling, there could be a lot of reasons for that, and you're probably right. Generally, going to a smaller nozzle sometimes will make it rumble less, but that may not be the real reason why it's doing that. It could be just the type of nozzle that was installed. You know, there's generally three different types of nozzles that they put in: a hollow pattern, a solid pattern, or something in between. And sometimes, depending on the boiler itself, a hollow nozzle is much quieter than a solid nozzle, but harder to start. A lot depends on the chamber. And, you know, it was very popular in the 80s to downsize the nozzle, you know, cut it down from a 1 to a 0.75. But the efficiency, which is really burner efficiency, is so tied into the shape of the size of the chamber that you reach a point of diminishing returns, where if you cut it down enough, not only do you run cold, but you run smoky. So generally, you can go 10% with no problem, even stretching 15%. But once you get more than that, unless you change the size of the combustion chamber itself, you're really starting to produce smoke and certain all that, and that just brings your whole efficiency way down.
If you've got the right kind of a so-called retention head burner, and you've also got that switch, which cuts off the oil instantaneously when the thermostat stops demanding fuel, you don't want the fuel to slowly dribble out of the nozzle as the pump slows down and as the blower slows down. You want that to cut off immediately. And by the same token, when it starts up, you'd like the blower to come up to full speed, you'd like the pump to come up to full pressure, and with a few second delay, the switch opens up and finally allows the oil to flow into the nozzle. So you end up with a hell of a lot cleaner burn, and a lot less soot, and a lot less burnt dribble of oil right at the tip of the nozzle, if you don't have that switch. When it comes to the nozzle itself, yeah, there's a lot of variables involved. Hollow, solid, 65, 75, 85 degrees of flare angle, and the ideal flare angle, an ideal solid versus hollow, which does the best job of converting, of coupling the flame BTUs into your heat exchanger, and the acoustics. I mean, I guess it's possible for the whole darn system to become one great big organ pipe, depending on the kind of nozzle, the gallons per hour, the cubic feet per hour of air, the length of the flue pipe, and whether or not it's got any bends in it, whether it's got any mechanical deresonators, if you know what I mean. I think in some cases, some of that rumble is really the hold down the furnace system acting like an organ pipe, is my guess. I wonder if you've ever seen any evidence of that, Pat. WB2CMF, KQLIW in the deck net.
KQLIW, WB2CMF. I have, but quite frankly, it's been a long time. I sort of started getting away from it. Getting back to the original question again, you know, you had mentioned about setting your air so that you actually run it, I guess, slightly lean on oil, rich on air. You know, if you had to do just one thing, go out and get yourself a smoke tester, because I found that you can measure the efficiency, but when it comes down to it, if you're putting out zero smoke or just below that, you're running about as efficient as you ever will, and the smoke tester is really not that expensive. And I'm not talking about the new electronic stuff that they have out, which costs a lot of money. These are just a simple, you know, paper type smoke testers that you can buy at Sid Harvey's or whatever. And if that's all you really want to do, that's all you really need, and you'll wind up doing pretty efficient. Again, with what you said, when there's soot in your boiler surfaces, I've seen the stack temperature go up by at least 50 to 100 degrees. Clean the boiler out and it drops, you know, like a miracle, it just drops by 100 degrees. So you know that soot is really your enemy.
Sure, it sure is. It's an extremely good insulator between that flame and your boiler. Although I don't own a smoke tester, in a very crude manner, I am getting a kind of a smoke test, because when I do, once every few years, clean my flue pipes, there isn't black soot in there. It's a deep brown kind of a deposit, which I think is the mineral matter in the oil. When you've got insufficient oxidation of the flame, it makes a black soot, which gets coated onto the flue pipes, and it's a really dirty job to clean them out. So if your flue pipes are brown in color instead of black, I think you're in the right direction. Also, another great advantage, in my opinion, for using an undersized nozzle is that, in my particular case, there's an amount of air that I would like to go into that flame. And when I opened up the vent mechanism for adjusting the air out of the blower into the blast tube assembly, let me drop it. My system was not able to supply enough air when I had the larger nozzle that came with the furnace. So the same amount of aperture opening around the squirrel cage blower, the same amount of air, so to speak, is going to give me a leaner flame if I'm using a smaller number of gallons per hour. Joe and I have looked at a couple of websites where these electronic testers for flue gases, you can really do a spectral analysis of your flue gases and their temperatures. And so there's some fancy instrumentation out there. And Joe and I have looked at that website, and we drooled. But the two of us said that they don't really want to pay those number of dollars. But Joe, too bad somebody doesn't give us one of those, so we don't have to pay those high prices, Joe. W2LYY, K2LYW in the tech net.
46.
Go ahead there, John.
When you finish the subject, you should go back to check-ins, because you didn't really complete that.
We did wait to see if anyone else was going to check in, and there was a dead time there, but we'll go back to that. Joe, are you still drooling over some of those fancy pieces of electronics by which we could be doing analysis of our oil burner? W2LYY, KQLIW, and TechNet.
Hang on a second here. My mechanism is not working correctly. I have to use my mouse pointer to make this thing transmit. So I'm coming in and like, oh yeah, you can dump your drool. I asked the guys at Sid Harvey, by the way, of that particular instrument that the guy used in the video, which is made by Steel Piece. And they said that's about a $300-$400 instrument. It does not measure, it may measure efficiency by some sort of roundabout calculation, but it doesn't directly measure, I think, CO2. It doesn't measure directly. It does it by some sort of a computing method. They said the other instruments they carry, which is made by another name, another company, I don't recall what it is right now, is probably close to about $1,000 that does all those kind of, tests. That's why I asked the initial question, is a way of doing this without spending a lot of money to do it. One other comment on this whole subject I'll tell you is we, both of us had a discussion of it with this one time offline, but since I put in the system where I have a way of cutting off the ignition to the ignition points, and it runs for about 5 seconds and it cuts off, the points are much, much better shape than they used to be with the ignition running all the time, just burning the hell out of the points. And even with the windy days we've had in the past couple of weeks or so, I've never had the flame get blown out. Besides, if it does, my system will go off in about 1 to 2 seconds maximum and do an auto reset on itself. Back to you.
Yeah, you've got a much more modern controller than I do, and that's a very nice function. Yeah, mine, the igniter stays on continuously. The right brand name of igniter, those points don't wear down very fast. I'm changing the nozzle once every year, and as such, I check the igniter points, and they're usually in pretty good shape. Seems to me like I've only got to replace my igniters once every 5 years or so. So maybe it's my particular transformer. In fact, the modern day transformer is now a transistorized device. It's no longer just a simple 10,000 volt transformer. It's really an inductive kickback ignition system, which I think gives you a nice high voltage spark with a rather low amount of current. I have reason to believe it's going to be pretty efficient on not chewing up my igniter points so fast. So the next time you replace your ignition transformer, I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised on that one, Joe. That's W2RYY, T2RIW in the TechNet.
I've had that replaced recently by a service technician about maybe 3 or 4 years ago because I had a problem with the thing, and ended up being the transformer the ignition transformer was bad. I had an intermittent one, but the one I was on was about 24 years old, or 23 years old. The one I have on there now is not solid state. The only rating I have on it, it says midpoint, secondary midpoint grounded, and 17 kilovolts peak at 45 mils. That's all I know about it, but it's not solid state as far as I can tell. But it seems to work okay.
Yeah, mine not only said it was solid state, but it had approximately 1/4 of the volume. I have been replacing my ignition transformers because they failed about once every 10 or 12 or 15 years, numbers like that. In fact, I got to the point there where I would have a spare ignition transformer sitting in my pile of parts ready to go because I know it's something that doesn't last forever. But these new solid state ones, much more compact, and I have reason to believe it's going to last longer. On the assumption they've done a good job of designing that ignition circuit itself. Okay, that was oil burners. A little bit unusual, but we do that once every 6 months or so. The technique gets into oil burners. And in the past, I get a whole lot of mail on that subject with people saying that, boy, am I glad you guys got into that. Eric, I think you had a question. If you do, take over right now. KE2EJ. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Now I was going to discuss a little more of what I discovered with the jig oscillator and mixer all in one package. But I'm going to move on because I've got something that I've got to do here right now. So I'll be back in like 10 minutes. Get the translator, then we'll talk about it. K2RIW, K2EJ.
One quick question. You made it sound like you had that YIG assembly, yttrium iron garnet, the YIG oscillator filter / assembly, mixer assembly, mailed to you, and the price was around $1,000. Did I hear you say that, Eric? Go ahead.
No, you didn't quite get it right. The manufacturer, they... the thing is mounted on a board, which is the RF spectrum analyzer. They get $6,000 for the device, which is the mixer, and the conductor. No, I've come up with a plan on how to fix it, and you actually have the pictures. The way the thing is constructed, where the actual gig pellet is in the part that you actually think is the mixer, held by beryllium rods. And if you look at the microscope part of the picture, those things that the two wires are connected to are the heaters, which heats the beryllium rods, which heats the piece of gig material. The mixer is in a Y configuration. Each one of those beryllium rods has a little adjuster on it. The actual mixer part of it, where the diodes are, is in part of that cover, but it's all soldered together. And the way that I would be able to get at the diodes is I have to get that cover off, and I think the only way I'm going to be able to do that is to put it in an oven, you know, an SMD type of thing, let it get hot enough where we can lift the whole thing off.
Now, you just brought back a memory that I completely forgot. The heater voltage, which I think is usually 24 volts, appears. In many cases, they've got a heater on them in order to increase the accuracy of current into the main coil versus the exact frequency it resonates at. So the Yig spheres are temperature sensitive. A lot of the technology goes into one of those. So that whole assembly is $6,000. That's getting close to the kind of price you and I would like to pay for a used spectrum analyzer. My guess is that if you bought a state-of-the-art spectrum analyzer today, that goes up to these old 18, 20, 24 gig frequency region, I bet you can rather easily spend $75,000 expensive instrumentation. Next person on the list was Dave, W82 Yankee Lima. Go right ahead, Dave. K2LIW in the second hand. My name is Dick.
I have an ICOM HF rate, a 751 alpha, and W mode, not using the gear. It gets more than one RF output. The radio sensitivity, I have heard tell that RF on the rear jack when you put the key in, and that bypass capacity. So my question is, what kind of path has got through my junk box, but I just want to know if it's not used and what values I should be trying to pull out of it. Other than
yeah, when you do put that capacitor across the key jack, and you want to really make sure that the wiring going up to your external key is not still acting like an antenna, putting the capacitor closer to the front panel might be helpful. I am guessing 100 picofarad, a couple of hundred picofarad, is all that's really required. Because if you actually, at most of the frequencies you and I operate at, the capacitor reactance of 100 or a couple hundred picofarad is a low enough number that not very much RF energy would exist across the key terminals anymore with that capacitor being present. I also, I'm keeping my fingers crossed, so to speak, that putting in that capacitor is going to solve your problem. I'm a little worried that that might not be it. Let's hope it is. That when you first go to the CW mode, does it not transmit until you press the key down the first time? If it goes into transmitting when you press the key down the first time, and then it keeps transmitting, yes, you've got a strong piece of evidence that RF feedback is aggravating the problem. But if you go to the CW mode and it's already transmitting before you press the key, then I'm a little bit worried that something else is going on there. By way of the schematic diagram and some troubleshooting procedures, you'll eventually get to the bottom of what's causing this. And it doesn't strike me as an extremely elaborate thing, assuming it's not a function that's built into a very elaborate integrated circuit. Let me drop. I may be living in the dark. hydraulic gauges, but most of the rigs that I've owned, the keying circuit was individual transistors, resistors, and capacitors. It wasn't a very elaborate integrated circuit with 50 pins on it, if you know what I mean. If it is an integrated circuit with 50 pins doing the keying function, life could be complicated. So answer me that first question, Dave. When you first go to the CW mode, does it not transmit until you press the key down the first time? To me, to Yankee Lemur, K2LAW, the second man.
Also, Dick, if he unplugs it, does it stop? If he unplugs the key.
Another very good test. Over to you for both of those, Dave.
Yeah, actually, you're correct. It's fine until you hit the key the first time, and then you just will stop transmitting. I was also thinking of putting capacitors in the plug, so I don't have to open up the radio, plug right, in the jack, so it would be the same thing as almost. And also putting a ferrite, the wire leading off the key, so I was hoping to use those in my YL.
Yeah, the experiment of unplugging it to see if it'll stop transmitting by way of the ferrite, by way of the bypass capacitor, and yes, there are miniature disc ceramic. My guess is the actual voltage on your key is probably under 10 volts, and so the chances of you running into a problem with the voltage rating of a small disc ceramic capacitor, that doesn't have to be a disc, but any kind of a small capacitor of the 100 or 200 picofarad rating region, there's no magic number there. Anything up to 1,000, 001 would still work. As the capacitor becomes too big, you'll eventually get kind of soft keying, if you know what I mean. But to build that capacitor into the connector at the end of the cable, right at the front panel, that's not a very crafty way to do it. And that'll stop, in theory, that stops the hold on the wiring to the key from acting like an antenna. If it really is RF pickup, it does suggest you've got a fair amount of RF energy flowing down the outside of your coax cable going to your antenna. By way of the right kind of a balancing device on the antenna could also be a great solution. Could there be enough RF in the shack to create phony keying? Does suggest that something is less than ideal with the antenna itself. I wonder if you've considered that one, Dave. The B2YYL, K2RIW in the tech net.
K2RIW in the tech net, W8QYL. Yeah, the antenna actually has a coupler at the B point of the long wire, and it matches according to documentation. Okay, it was not supposed to be a lot of RF coming back down the coax, but could be wrong. So I will attempt to try that deal about pulling out the key. Let you know about that. But it sounds like the answer to the question, basically any little capacitor that'll fit in there. And I assume this is a stereo key that capacitor goes from the ground, the common, to other two
sectors
in there, correct?
I think the answer to that one is yes, Dave. Not positive, but I think the answer is yes. Also, an NFED antenna, sounds like a commercial product, a poor man's balance. In other words, the coax cable feeding the antenna. That's reasonably close to the antenna. If you run a few turns of the coax as a coil and hold it together with a black tape, that will be an RF choke that goes a long way toward stopping RF energy from flowing down the rest of the transmission line and getting into the shack. So a poor man's balance of a number of turns of the coax. And your next question is going to be how many turns and what diameter, depending on what coax. If it was RG8, Marching 213. I guess that would make it a roughly a 2 foot diameter and 4 turns. I'm not sure of the exact number, but what you're trying to do is to make the